Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hello and welcome to How to Be Sound, where for this episode I'm joined by none other than award-winning novelist and columnist Louise O'Neill, where we sat down to talk about feminism, writing, and why sometimes self-care just means going home for a while, or for a long while. Before we get into it though, I did want to say a few little words about Patreon. So I have mentioned a couple of times that I have a Patreon page set up for How to Be Sound. It's at patreon.com/howtobesound. So essentially, if you're enjoying the content that I'm creating here and you want to contribute a little bit of money, Patreon allows you to do that. It's a kind of a form of Kickstarter, and you can pledge $3.33, $6.66 or $9.99 per month to pay for essentially the content that you are right now consuming. You'll get little bonus bits. If you're a patron at the $6.66 level or more, you'll get an extra special mini-sode with every episode of How to Be Sound. And this time around, we have Louise O'Neill reading from her brand new novel, Almost Love, which is an extra special treat.
Now you're making me really nervous to start.
So, Louise, thank you so much for inviting us into your glorious hotel room.
Sorry, I know. I felt just slightly weird when I was asking you to come meet me in my hotel room. I was like, should I open the door in my bathroom? But no, sorry, too soon. Probably too soon for Harvey Weinstein jokes.
It is a bit too soon. I'm very disgusted by how distasteful that was.
I'm sorry.
You're staying in, the Fitzwilliam is 5-star, isn't it?
Yes.
So
yes,
you're living your best life now.
Yeah, well, I actually love this hotel. Our next door neighbours, who are like practically family, the father, Tom, is the wealth manager for the guy who owns the hotel. So I've been staying here for years, which I know makes me sound incredibly precious. And I know how lucky I am, but it is my favourite hotel in Dublin.
No, but I'm actually really glad that you now have like an Irish connection, because I have frequently seen you staying in the Fitzwilliam and been like, who does she like the mad notions on this staying in the Fitzwilliam hotel?
No. As I said, it's just, you know, my next door neighbour always kind of, and he likes it, you know, and I put it up on social media and he's delighted. And, you know, so, and as I said, I've been staying here for years, so.
And like, do you always get the same room? Are you the diva who's like, I want my room?
Oh God, no!
My suite.
Are you kidding? I'll take whatever room they'll give me. You know, I mean, once though we were up with Tom and Ronnie, and they were staying in the penthouse, and so we got to stay there, and that. I feel like I sort of peaked at 21. So that was like a really amazing experience. So I always feel, you know, slightly disappointed that I haven't quite reached, you know, the heights that I can do that by myself. Yes, you know.
Yeah, there's still time.
Yeah.
I was actually just going to say, I do think staying in a penthouse, or even I got a penthouse tour once at the Conrad. Like when I used to work as a journalist, I'd go on the odd press trip. So you'd stay in really nice hotels and you'd always get a really, really lovely room, because they do give you the best room because they want you to say their hotel's amazing. So yes. They give you the amazing room. But I remember getting the penthouse tour of the Conrad and literally just being like, everything from here on in is going to be a disappointment.
I know. Yeah. It's terrible.
And then when like Stephen and I went on holidays, we went on a package holiday a couple of years ago and stayed in like a really nice four-star hotel. And we got into our room, we were just like, is this it?
Yeah.
Because the two of us were so spoiled. Do you mean that we're so used to these really, really nice rooms? It does ruin all other hotels for you. Okay, so we're here, we're in the Fitzwilliam. This actually feels kind of surreal. Like, we're here, we're in this 5-star hotel. You're on your fourth book.
That is out now. And the next book, Surface Breaks, is out in May. So it's
so you're really not giving yourself a lot of time.
No, it's going to be a really full-on year because, you know, the play of Asking For It is also premiering in June. And
is that coming to the Abbey Theatre?
Yes.
We're getting our plugs in really early. I like
yes,
this.
Yes, oh yeah. I'm just very well trained. So that is premiering in the Everyman in Cork in June and then coming to the Abbey in November, which is, I mean, obviously just like a dream come true, to be honest.
So are you going to be doing a Saoirse Ronan on it and like sneaking in with your mom?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I've already got tickets for about like 20 different performances because all of my friends want to go and they're all sort of like separate little groups. So I feel like I'm going to, at the end, be sort of reciting the play as we go along. But yeah, I don't know, would I sneak in? I might do.
and just sort of see what people's reaction is to it when they all wear a disguise, you know, and a big hat and a funny pair of glasses.
Have you seen it yet?
I haven't seen it yet. They're in, they're casting at the moment. So they've been sort of sending me photos of the actors, which is just really surreal because, you know, when people say, oh, I always had this person in mind.
This is for the play.
Yeah. So it is just very surreal because when people say, you know, did you ever have any actresses or anything of that in mind? I don't tend to. I actually tend to, I would never base a character on a real person, but I would do sometimes like physically.
I would see
someone, I'd be like, oh, that actually, that kind of look is sort of, you know, what I'm thinking of in my head. So it's just been really, really strange, I think, seeing the photos of the actors that they're casting and being like, oh, okay, so this is what Emma looks like to other people, you know?
It's
incredibly exciting.
And do you think if it's really shit, are you going to be like doing a, like, do you think you'll be doing a Jamie Dornan?
Rosary.
Do you think you'll be doing a Jamie Dornan and being really embarrassed? Or do you think you'll be good at like keeping your game face?
No. It really annoys me the way Jamie Dornan acts really embarrassed. I mean, you know, and the way he seems so mortified by the fact that he has to do sex scenes. I mean, you were signing up for 50 Shades of Grey. You knew what you were getting. And also, you just have to be professional. Like, yeah. I know it's difficult if you don't think, you know, the finished product is any good. I know that's difficult, but I think you have a professional obligation to, you don't have to gush or you don't have to like be really like,
but you have to be sound.
Yeah, and you have to just, you know, respect the fact that, you know, that the people have worked really hard on this, and, you know, I've sort of given it to the production company to make of it, you know, what they will, and the actors will make the roles, and, you know, see, look how good I am. I'm so good.
You're very good already.
Yeah, and so I'm preparing. No, it's going to be amazing.
You know the way they're sending, so they're sending you the actors, is that for approval or is it just to keep you in the loop?
No. It actually, which was funny because obviously, you know, they're in pre-production with the movie of the first novel, and like I...
That's Only Ever Yours.
Only Ever Yours. And they have, like, I'm much more involved in that. And I think it's because myself and the producer, we get on really, really well. And so she's really sort of kept me with every step of the way, you know, with the script, with the director, with the cast. I've been incredibly involved. But with the play, you know, it really was just handing it over and seeing what, you know, well, I'll be just as surprised. I haven't seen a script. I haven't seen anything like that. So I think I'll just be just as surprised on opening night as everyone else. But
which is kind of nice. So it gets to be a new thing for you too.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it's funny. People always ask about, you know, would you write a sequel to this or would you write another book? And, you know, I suppose in a series, you know, carrying on from one of the original books that I've written. And I get bored so easily. I just, once I'm finished with a project, like, I'm really finished. Like, I haven't reread any of the books. I mean, I would rather die. I really, really would.
How many times do you think you've read them?
Oh, God. I mean, when you're editing, you just read and reread and reread and reread. God, each book, maybe 60 times.
Oh, Jesus.
Yeah, so I mean, I absolutely hate them by the end. And then you have to go into, so I am quite good at that. Then you have to go in and like sell them.
So there's no wonder you're not reading them again.
At publicity, and you're like, oh, it's amazing. And secretly, you're like, this is such a terrible book.
And you're probably doing readings as well.
Yeah. Well, I have like, you know, you always have sort of a section that you'll do for a reading. So I would be, I would be used to that. I'm always very suspicious of people who really love reading their own work, or, you know, who think they're like, oh my, you know, think incredibly highly of their own work.
I think there's a high crossover between people who love reading their own work and people who wake up in the morning and go, yeah, there you are, like, hey, good looking, you know, like positive affirmations, but they're not doing it to make, you know, to boost their self-esteem. They're doing it because they genuinely think that person in the mirror is incredible.
Yeah, well, I mean, I do a lot of positive affirmations and I do a lot of sort of self-talk and, you know, trying to sort of boost my self-esteem, but there's something, I don't know, I as I said, I'm just suspicious of people who don't find reading their own work an incredibly cringeworthy and excruciating experience. So.
Have you read Meg Wolitzer's The Wife?
Yes, I have.
So I'm kind of two thirds of the way through it. And I think it's really interesting the way she presents
him as the writer being, and I do think there's a kind of a gender bit, because I wonder if there are more men who don't mind reading their own work, because women are, we're kind of conditioned to be a little bit embarrassed.
That's a really interesting book on the role of, I think, the artist, and you know, the role of the artist's spouse, particularly if you're their wife, and I suppose the value that we place on men's work over women's work.
But
I don't know. I mean, I suppose, you know, I don't really want to make that generalization, because I know like loads of male writers who would sort of roll their eyes at the idea of, you know, the great artiste. I do think it's a slightly outdated idea. Most writers that I know are pretty sound and just very normal. Do you know, like Lisa McInerney, who's just such an incredible writer, is just the most down to earth, like no bullshit person you'll ever meet. And I personally prefer that, because I think, yes, you know, I take my work really seriously, and I take what I do seriously, but I think if you start taking yourself seriously,
it's all over.
It's just so tedious.
But you know what's funny? I think that like social media and paparazzi and the constant news cycle has made it much more difficult for people to be dickheads. So like when you see something, have you seen Phantom Thread?
No, I haven't.
So the film that came out last month with Daniel Day-Lewis, which is his last, I really hope it's his last movie for his wife's sake, because I feel like him being method just must be so incredibly head-wrecking. But in it, he's this like incredible wanker of an artist. And I'm like, I don't think you would get away with that now, because people would be on social media going, oh my God, you know who I just saw being rude to somebody in Tesco? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But like this kind of thing, there's too much scrutiny on everyone.
Yeah, no,
you
it's
just
true.
Don't get away with it.
You know, I always think that must be quite hard if you're famous, because like sometimes you're just not in a great mood, or sometimes, you know, the service somewhere is terrible and you have to, I mean, not be rude, but you have to sort of, you know,
you want to
say
take something,
someone to task or say, look, actually, this isn't acceptable. But I feel like if you were famous, you'd have to just swallow that slightly and, you know, be like, oh, just keep smiling.
Well, it must kind of happen to you, because like, it happens to me sometimes when people approach me, and if I'm not in a good mood, or I'm not in a good like place, for want of a less kind of American, I'm not in a good place right now.
Yeah.
And people will approach me and be like, oh my God, I follow you on social media, or I do this. And I'm like, I really need to be nice to this person, because it's really nice. You
it
know
is
what I mean?
Really
it's a really
nice
moment.
Yeah.
But I'm also like, I didn't necessarily sign up for this.
No, I agree. And actually, I think it's always worse in Dublin or Cork, I think, because obviously, and which is partly the reason why I live in a small town, is because everyone, if people recognise me, it's because, oh, that's Holly O'Neill's daughter, you know, that sort of way.
Yeah.
And I actually found that really difficult. You know, especially, I mean, you don't become a writer to get recognised. Like, you know, that just doesn't, that just doesn't happen. So I think when that did start happening, when people, and you know, people would be really lovely, but you know, sometimes I'd be having lunch by myself, and then someone would come up and they'd say, oh, you know, I've just been sort of, I saw, you know, I've been sort of looking at you for the last half an hour, I'm not sure if I should approach you or not. And I would just start feeling really self-conscious.
Yeah. And that's a really weird idea too, that you're like, who else has been watching you for half an hour?
No, absolutely. And I suppose actually, and I think a lot of it for me was tied into having had an eating disorder, and sometimes not feeling very comfortable eating in front of people.
Okay.
So then
someone is
like, I've been watching you eat your sandwich for the last half an hour. I was like, okay, that's fine. I'm going to be fine about this. So I think it was just the self-consciousness and being very self-aware. And for that moment, kind of splitting out from myself, if that makes sense, and seeing myself like from the way someone else sees me.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I've struggled with and have been really careful. You know, I never read interviews with myself about, you know, or I never read features about me. I never, you know, look at Amazon reviews. I never look at, you know, boards, or I never Reddit or whatever. I never Google myself. I don't listen back to interviews, because I did at the start, and it was this very odd experience of, particularly sometimes with, let's say if a feature has been written on you and you're reading someone's interpretation
of you.
Yeah, yeah. And it feels like you're eavesdropping, and it never felt comfortable. And I think I've fought so hard to have a very grounded sense of myself, and that's something that doesn't come naturally. That's something that I work on every single day, you know. So then when that started happening, and it was like I knew that I had to sort of protect myself from that, and that is a big part of why I live at home.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yes, that's so interesting, because it is like, Because I am exactly the opposite. I read boards and Reddit all the time. And
I don't mean this in a bad way, but I'm like, I don't know how you sleep. Because I honestly, genuinely, maybe you've got a thicker skin than I do. Because
I don't think, I don't know. Like, I read it and there, it kind of depends on the mood I'm in. Mm. So like, you know, it depends on the place I'm in. That it, like, if I'm in really good, kind of good form, or if I'm feeling very strong, I can read it and be like, well, you know what, this person clearly has an issue with me and is taking this out and saying it this way by criticizing something that I've done. And then other times I'll read it and I'll just be like, oh my God, I didn't realize, but I'm actually an ass. You know, like, I don't think I'm an asshole, but I'm obviously an asshole. Do you know what I mean?
No, you're not. And actually...
No. I mean, I know, but like, you know, on those days.
Yeah,
that
no.
I'm like, oh God, that's true. Like, what this person is saying about me is right.
No. And actually, just looking from the outside in, you know, when I see... Because obviously, you know, I know you and I've known you for about 2 or 3 years now at this stage. And you know, I've always found you to be very forthright and very... you know, direct and very honest. And I really like that. I really like there's no bullshit. Like, you know, you kind of say it as it is. And I really appreciate that just directness in people. And I think it's so easy when I read, let's say, some of the comments that you maybe, you know, if you've taken a screenshot of a Boards Daddy thing, it's really easy for me on the outside to look at that and say, that's actually completely bullshit. Like, these people are projecting all of their own insecurities and these very gendered ideas about what women are supposed to, you know, do and what women are supposed to behave like. And, you know, it's so obvious to me that it's a projection of all of their own insecurities and their own shit. But I know that if, you know, well, I'd be like, well, no, that's not true about Rosemary. That's definitely not true about Rosemary. But I know I would be like, but it's really, that's 100%
it's true
about
me. Yeah. But it is, I mean, because like academically, I can look at it and go, oh, this means this about this person. Mm. But then when it's about yourself.
Yeah.
And I kind of, I do go through phases. So like, I go through phases where I try really hard not to. So I'll take 3 or 4 weeks and I won't read any forums and I won't read anything like about anybody. Mm. And then I'll suddenly get a Google alert, or I'll get something, I'll be like, oh God.
Yeah.
And then I'll kind of get like sucked down the wormhole. But I was going to say that, like, you kind of touched on it there, but like, you didn't really, like, you didn't go into writing to become the voice of feminism in Ireland.
I mean, that always makes me laugh, because it's like, I'm like, as if I'm the only feminist in the village. Like, yeah. I mean, there's quite a few people that are doing Trojan work here. I'm just sort of, you know, trucking along.
And like, how do you feel about the fact that... Because it is unusual for a writer to be writing, especially fiction. Do you know what I mean? To be writing novels and to be so at the forefront of that.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? For it to be you and for you, your name and your face to be recognised.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I think I've always believed that if you had a voice, that you should do something, with it. And I think, you know, growing up, my dad in particular had a very strong sense of justice and a very strong sense of that if you saw that something was happening and that you didn't feel that was right, that you should speak up. And I feel like I didn't do that as a teenager, and I regretted it. And I think then the more that I really started to come into my own as a woman, and just really, I suppose, try and be honest and be authentic and be myself, using my voice and being honest about how I felt about, you know, political issues, it just became so automatic.
Yeah, it was the obvious.
It really was. And I suppose what I find interesting is that I don't think I'm that out. Like, you know, I know that I'm outspoken. I know that I'm opinionated, but I always think I'm actually quite measured. So when you get this reaction that, you know, you're this radical anarchist feminist, yeah, who is, you know, I don't know, that your opinions are just so completely ridiculous and off the wall, and that I still to this day will get really surprised by the vitriol that will come after someone's read an article, because I'm
that you
like,
think is very neutral,
so measured, and that I've really but you know, again, what was that article that you wrote?
Was it about kids and social media?
No,
because
I think it was
that's the one I always think about, like, that I wrote this piece about how, you know, maybe we should not, and it wasn't that we should never put our kids in social media, but that we should think about overexposing them.
Yeah.
For
yeah.
two reasons. It was like, you know, for their own safety, but also for their own sense of privacy, that when they get older, they're going to have this huge footprint that they haven't signed up for.
I know.
And the reaction was, like, I felt so extreme to something that I was going, like, A, was not an original thought. You know what I mean? That I was like, I've read this article 10 million times. It's just that it's in my voice this time. And people were like, this is so, like, anti-mother. You're really putting mothers down. This is so... And, like, we're really, really upset and really angry about it. And I was so shocked.
I know. And because I do remember reading that article and I did think it was very measured. But then you see, the thing is that I'm not a mother. And I see with friends of mine who have children, the pressure that they're under. And it just feels exhausting. And I think the problem is that there's so much pressure on women to be perfect in general. Yeah. And that really spills over into when they become
into
mothers.
Motherhood, yeah.
And I think there's such a sense of responsibility because you have this human being and you're trying to, I suppose, you know, make sure that they survive and that they're okay and that they're happy and healthy. So I think sometimes I can see with friends of mine that if someone is doing something completely different to them, it can feel like almost as if...
Like a judgment
on their own decisions. Yeah. And I think you're so afraid that you're making a mistake and you're just doing your best, that I do think that's where the defensiveness comes from. It comes from a sense of, I think, just fear and just hoping that, you know, that you're not fucking up your child. And like,
well, in all things, I think it does.
Yeah. No, I agree. I just think it's such a hard job. Like, I feel like, cause, you know, I've been in therapy since I was 17, and I will sometimes come home and say things to my parents, you know, just talking. And I mean, I'm really close with my parents. And, you know, I'll discuss something and I'll say, oh, you know, when this happened, when I was seven, and my mom's like, oh God. She was like, I'm sorry, I was probably just not having a bad day. And it's just so easy, I think, to, I don't know, say or do the wrong thing. I just think parents in general are, I couldn't do it. So I sort of have a lot of respect. But
it is kind of nuts, isn't it, when you get older and you realise that your parents are just adults the way we are right now.
I know.
And raising tiny children and like doing their best.
I know. Mine were so young as well. Like, they were 21 getting married, 22 having my sister, was it 24 having me. So they, you know, they were super young.
Yeah,
so
it's, and like, because I have similar conversations in therapy, and I remember in the early days I would talk to my parents about it, and like, we are very close as well, but my parents wouldn't be into therapy, or they wouldn't be very kind of analytical in terms of mental health and stuff. And when I talked to them a couple of times about it, I remember my sister calling me and being like, you need to go easy on mom and dad because it's not their fault. Mm. And I was like, oh my God, like, I didn't think I was going, well, I found out today that you did this to me. But I was more kind of going, you know what we were talking about today? But they were taking it, I think, a little bit personally.
I know. And the thing is that it isn't about blaming. Like, I mean, that's the whole point of therapy, is that there is no blame because we're all doing the best that we can. And I also have made mistakes and have done things that, you know, I regret. And, you know, you just try and make amends and kind of keep going. And that's, you know, as I said I've been in therapy since I was 17.
Yes.
The use the therapy speak comes out quite
so
a lot.
You have a lot of thoughts.
Yes, I have a lot of
feelings.
I do, and I feel them. I feel them all, Rosemary.
Do you ever regret I guess kind of becoming a public voice or becoming a public figure? I know you said that, like, you do believe that we should speak out when we have a platform, but have there been any moments where you've been like,
oh, absolutely, absolutely. And I had to take a huge step back. I think 2016 was such, I mean, no, okay. When I first started the book, Only Ever Yours came out in 2014. And I was talking quite a lot, obviously, about eating disorders and body image, because that was very much directly related to the book. And then when Asking For It came out, I was talking a lot about, obviously, about sexual violence and my own experiences of that. And, you know, it was a really strange experience, because I had made the decision to be very open and honest about these things, because I think it's really important that we destigmatize these issues, because there is such a lot of, I think, latent shame attached to it, which is just completely, you know, it's just completely incorrect, because there shouldn't be any shame attached to mental health issues or issues around sexual or domestic violence. But, you know, you're talking about it in an interview situation. It's not really a safe space. You know, it's someone who wants to get the story. And, you know, most people were very respectful. But sometimes, you know, I would leave a lot of interviews feeling completely empty. Like, there's just this gnawing hollowness inside me. And I was trying to sort of fill it up. You know, and I wasn't sure how to do that. And I just, I was really struggling. Like, by 2016, by the end of that, I was completely burnt out. And I felt really anxious. I was, you know, struggling to eat. I'd lost a lot of weight. I really genuinely couldn't cope. And I think I had to take, and I suppose as well, you know, the added pressure of, the, you know, online trolling and, you know, and abuse and sort of abusive messages that way, and trying to be very strong and trying to say, well, you know, I'm not going to be bullied and I'm not going to be, you know, pushed off social media. And then realizing at the end of 2016 that I felt very close to sort of not like a breakdown, but just really I was at the end of my tether.
Yeah.
So I took 2017, I took a step back. I turned down every sort of media request that came my way. I continued reading my column, but I took a lot more breaks off social media. I went full on with recovery. Like, you know, now I go to a specialized therapist every week. I go to a nutritionist every week. I have online coaching every week. I do yoga 4 times a week. I run 5 times a week, you know, that I really, for a massage every week. I get acupuncture every month. You know, I just went full on into it. I mean, I'm definitely the healthiest I've ever been.
It takes work.
Oh my God, yeah. So much work. And I think the thing is that it really made me realise, firstly, that I was lucky that I had the time to do it. And secondly, I was so lucky to have the financial resources.
Yeah.
Because I would never have had, I mean, you know, and obviously, you know, I'm not, like, I come from a middle class background. I'm not sort of saying, oh, you know, poor me or anything like that. You know, I've always been very lucky that way. But I was like, well, I can spend money on this. And it just really made me examine, I think, our two-tier health service, particularly around mental health issues, and that I suppose I had access to an entire sort of support system that created this network that really just meant that I'm the healthiest now than I've been since I was probably 14. I think it's been interesting coming into this year and knowing that there's going to be a lot of publicity and a lot of promotion, a lot of getting my photo taken, a lot of, you know, trying to find clothes to wear, and a lot of, you know, I think after a year of the only way that I thought about my body was how fast can I run and how many words can I write a day? Yeah. And then all of a sudden, you know, getting back into what does my body look like?
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
And, you know, trying to, I suppose, do that part of my job, but not let it get in the way that it has done previously. So being really, really mindful and just, you know, which is, as I keep saying, is why I like to go home. You know, in between, I just go home, I don't wear any makeup. It feels like a kind of a little cocoon where I can just shut out the rest of the world and just go back to being the real me rather than sort of the public persona of Louise O'Neill, author.
I often think Irish people are kind of lucky in that respect, that even if and when we get, like, famous, and I don't mean me and I don't even necessarily mean you, but even, kind of someone like Colin Farrell, where you're kind of internationally famous, that you can still come home and go to the pub.
Exactly. And people might say hi. Or Hosier, you know, just like normal, can lead normal lives here.
Yeah. And it is really nice. And that we have, like, small towns and villages where people are too scarlet, basically, to come up and go, oh my God, I love you. You know what I mean? Yeah. It doesn't happen. Yeah. Or, like, I was just looking at Busy Phillips on Instagram, and she was in Target, and she was like, oh my God, there's a guy in Target being chased around by preteens. She was like, I can't figure out who he is, I think he must be a YouTube star. And she asked the cashier, and the cashier was like, yeah, he's a YouTube star. And I was like, I just don't think that would happen here.
No,
even
no.
with kids.
Yeah, no, I agree.
I agree, which is great.
Yeah,
I
think it is really nice.
I don't know. I think as well, people, it's sort of like, I wouldn't give them the satisfaction that much as well. Do you know, if they saw someone famous, you know, God, you wouldn't want them to get any notions about themselves.
Yeah, the notions.
Yeah. And actually, it's funny. I think someone like, interestingly, I think Irish people love an Irish star. So I think someone like a Miriam O'Callaghan would actually find it more difficult to go around her everyday life or a Ray Darcy than someone like a Saoirse Ronan, which is funny. Do you know, I suppose maybe they're actually instantly recognisable because they're on Irish TVs like,
but
all
I
the
also
time.
Think when you're on Irish TV and you're on daytime, you feel accessible. People think that they're that you're their mate.
Yes.
You know what I mean? That they're I've seen you on my telly and I
therefore
gotta come up and say
you.
Hi
and also I'm paying your wages.
Yeah,
that seems to be a big thing with people who work for RTE.
Yeah, that is a hard thing.
We'll be right back after this break.
Meet Your Maker is a podcast about the people who make the things we love, hosted by me, Liam Geraghty. In season one, we met composers, anime voice actors, writers on Sesame Street, a geeky priest who restores harmoniums in Cavan. It was nuts. In season two, we are upping the ante.
I leapt up from the chair, my hair was dripping dye, and I said, I have to make a phone call.
I used to write letters to, you know, say comedians like Janine Garofalo, and they'd write back really nice letters, like saying, like, you're so mature for a 15-year-old. And in my head, I kind of be like, yeah, like, I could be friends with Janine Garofalo.
One of his friends, this older guy, he shakes my hand, and I get up to shake his hand, and then he grabs my hand and pulls me in super close. In my ear, he's like, if you give him any drugs, I'll kill you.
If you want to know what that's all about, Meet Your Maker is out now, wherever you get your podcasts, or see meetyourmaker.ie. That's meetyourmaker.ie.
So you did mention there, this is a good segue, you did mention there being kind of lucky enough to be able to afford therapy and even yoga. Yoga classes are well, actually probably better in Cork than they are here, but they're so expensive.
Yeah, no, they are expensive. I suppose the thing is, I don't drink. I haven't had anything to drink since last April. And, you know, so I suppose there's certain ways that I don't spend maybe money that other people would spend on things like that. I think it is just... And this probably sounds a bit dismissive, as in it was just about your priorities. I think that's totally fine. I think that, you know, if other people are like, actually, the way I blow off steam is going to the pub on a Friday night with some friends. And I'm like, yeah, perfect. But that just wouldn't be for me.
But also, you know what? Like, I eat out a lot. And like people have kind of asked me either on social media, and also my boyfriend's always having a go at me and being like, oh, you're always eating out. But like, I don't drink. And I do always use as an...
Yeah.
Like as a retort that I'm like, well, you spend 100 quid on Friday.
Yeah, yeah,
do you know
exactly
what I mean? And if I eat out like lunch five times a week, that's 100 quid.
Yeah. Oh, I do love your Instagram though, Rosemary. I'm always like, oh God, that looks amazing.
Yeah, but you can make anything look amazing, really. I mean, most of the things I do put on Instagram, I generally don't lie about food, but it is easy to make food look good.
Is it?
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever actually put a photo of anything that I've eaten up on Instagram. So because every time I've tried, it always
so cool.
No, it's not that. I'm always just like, oh, I don't know. Yeah.
You just need to go and get some good pancake stacks. You need to look for the Instagram cliches.
Okay. I'll try today now.
I did put up a picture of some scallops the other day and I was a bit surprised because it did really, like, Instagram is so unpredictable to me that I'm like, this is a beautiful photograph, it's going to do so well, and then it gets like 20 likes.
Yeah.
And the scallops got about 450 and they looked shit. Like, it was just two tiny scallops on a plate.
They did look very tasty, actually.
Well, scallops are delicious.
Yeah, they are.
But no, listen, sorry, back to the money.
Yeah.
What I was going to say was, are you a millionaire yet?
Rosemary, you can't ask me that.
I totally can.
I am very lucky and I feel very fortunate for how things are going. It's an odd thing being an artist. It's an odd thing because, you know, I've had like two really good years. Look, how will I put this? I was at university. I did my postgraduate. I did my undergraduate. I moved to New York. I was interning there. Then I came home with €50 in my bank account.
I'm impressed.
Oh, yeah. I don't think
I've ever come back from America with anything in my bank account. It's amazing.
And then I took a year out to start writing. So I wasn't earning that year. And then I got my book deal and it was 15,000 for two books. So, 7,500
per book.
Euro for like a year's work. And then it took
a couple of years before things started. So I, you know, I really didn't start earning properly until the last 2 years. So I had a, like two very good years.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's absolutely impossible to tell, you know, because
what's
you know,
going to happen in the next 10 years.
Yeah. And then I was
years,
like, you know, I should really buy a house. And, you know, then you're going and talking to banks and they're like, well, how much do you earn a year? And you're like, I don't know. I really don't know. Yeah. You know, it's really, it's so hard to predict.
Yeah. It's so funny because I remember talking to a friend of mine, Jean Sutton, about this. And we were talking about that. I was saying that I wanted to write a book.
Jean.
Oh, no, she's great. Yeah. But we were talking about how great she is on Instagram as well. My friend was like, she should be like an influencer because she's so gas. Like, yes. She's really funny and really smart.
She is hilarious.
But we were talking about writing and I was like, I just want to write my book and like give up work. And she was like, you know, nobody makes money from books. Mm. And I was like, no, they do because Cecilia Hearn. She was like, no. She's like, Cecilia Hearn has ruined it for everyone. Because like Cecilia Hearn was the one that everyone's like, oh, six figures for this or whatever. And she's like, but that's just so rare.
It is very
rare.
That
anybody makes kind of big money. And that kind of €15,000 example for the first two books is a really good concrete example.
But you know what? I will say that my problem with that is that I think we're and I agree with Jean. I think that, you know, for most people and most authors do have to have a second job, you know, and I do feel very privileged that I can make, you know, a very comfortable living you know, writing my books. But I also think that it's a mistake to go into it and say no writers make any money, because there are writers who make money. And, you know, maybe they're not making Cecilia or Marion Keyes type money, you know, but that they might be earning, you know, like a good wage that they can live off every year. And it is getting, you know, it is getting trickier because I think people, I think, tend to want their art for free these days, you know, whether that's music or whether it's TV or whether it's books, you know, and illegally streaming it or downloading it. And, you know, look, I'm not going to say, oh, I'm perfect and I've never, you know, streamed a television show. But I suppose there is a part of me that's like, you know, we really do need to value art and value the work that, you know, because I know myself when I'm writing, like, it's bad, you know, not backbreaking work. I'm not down a mine, but like, you know, it's not the easiest,
it's not easy,
you know,
no.
that kind of way. Yeah. And I'm very lucky and I love it. But you know, it's also, it's not the easiest job in the world or anything.
Well, you're working.
Yeah, you are. You're exactly. I'm working.
It's work.
And you know, people deserve to get paid for what they make. But I think it's a mistake to sort of frighten people off and say, well, no one makes any money. Because the thing is, people do make money. And my attitude has always been for everything, well, why shouldn't it be me? Like, you know, it's like, well, why shouldn't I be successful?
The
or
one,
why
yeah.
shouldn't, you know, because it has to happen to someone.
Yeah.
So I think it's just, while I think I suppose no one really goes into creating art of any kind. You know, hopefully the reason why you go into it is because you love it and, you know, you have that urge to create or that urge to write or that urge to paint. But I also think it's about putting value on yourself, on your work, on your time and expecting that you should be paid and that you should, you know, that. And I think it's about trying to balance the two of those, because I think sometimes people sort of, you know, assume with artists that, oh, should you do it for free? Or, you know, and I'm like, well, actually, I love it. And I would feel very, I know myself that I would feel incredibly unsettled and sort of off balance if I wasn't able to write.
If I couldn't do it. But that doesn't mean you want to do it for free.
Oh, no, absolutely not. Yeah. Because, you know, it's my job and everyone deserves to get paid.
What's the most outlandish thing you've ever been asked to do for free? Do you want to think about it and I'll give you mine?
Yes, do it.
Because I got an email last week from a PR company working with American Airlines, right? And they said, we're doing a video for our in-flight entertainment and it's going to be a two-day shoot and we're going to be going around North Dublin and we really want you to be the face of it and to show us around North Dublin and, you know, the I think it was like the North Inner City, which is where I live and where you like to eat and where you like to go out and maybe theatres and stuff. And I was like, oh my God, great, that sounds brilliant. And I really wanted to do it because I'm now working kind of pretty much full time as a personal trainer. And like, I'm making kind of, I'm making a small living from that. You know, I'm just kind of getting started. And so I was going, I really want to do this because I could do with the extra money, but also because it kind of sounds fun.
Yeah.
And I was kind of going, in-flight American Airlines, not that many people would see that. So like, I wouldn't have to be scarlet about like, here, I love like this farmer's market that I've never been to before. So I got back and I said, okay, I'll do it for, I think I said $2,500 because I was going, I'd do it probably for $1,500, but I'm going to say $2,500 and they can bargain me down.
Yeah.
And she got back and she said, I'm afraid as we don't have the support of the tourist board, we can only offer you €200 for the 2 days.
Are you Rosemary?
Yeah. And I was like, no, you don't need the support of the tourist board because you have the support of an airline.
Yeah.
So I just said,
that is a very
thanks,
good point.
But no.
Like, it's, It's, you know what I will say though, at the start, you know, I would have done a few events here and there, or spoken at things for free. But actually it was my sister, interestingly enough, who is a primary school teacher, told me very early on, like, I mean, I'm talking only ever yours might have been out a couple of months, she was like, you can't be doing things for free. Yeah. And I said, why? And she said, well, if someone asked me to come in and speak to a class, or if I was asked, you know, to do something, she said, I would expect to be paid.
Yeah.
She said, if we were having someone in here to speak at school, you know, she said, I would presume they would be getting paid. And she said, you have to put, she said, you don't even have to ask for that much, you know, she said, but just make sure that, you know, if you're in for an hour that you're getting, I don't know, even 100 euros. She said,
yeah.
Even,
you know, you're putting a value on your time.
Exactly. Yeah. So very early on, I would have said, and as I said, it was never, you know, it wouldn't always, you know, as I said, it could have just been 100 euro. But it was just to ensure that I think that I was valuing myself, and also that the person who was asking for my time was valuing my expertise, such as it is, and the fact that, you know, it's not that easy to go in and speak. You know, no. I'm not trained in, like, you know, to go in to speak to a classroom of students, or and I do find it's funny, you know, you give so much and you expend so much energy, and you really, they ask so many questions, and they really, you know, and you just give so much. That you can walk away feeling absolutely exhausted.
Yeah.
And I think it just would feel even worse if I was like, oh God, I just did that for free. Yeah. I know that sounds, maybe that sounds slightly mercenary, but I think I am quite practical in a lot of ways. And I think that's been useful in my career, is that I am, which is funny, people always get very surprised at this, because it's obviously not the attitude that I'm projecting. An ex-boyfriend was like, I had talked about negotiating a deal and sort of getting three times as much as what they had originally offered, and he was like, really? You? I was so offended.
I should start forwarding you my American Airlines emails.
Yes, exactly.
Like, Louise, deal with this for me.
I think I always ask for more. Which I think is quite rare with women, because I'm always a bit like, as you said, they can always, you know, they'll negotiate it down, or they might, but you know, you may as well start sort of at the top and see what they have to offer. Yeah. So I've always had that sort of part of my brain as well, which I think has been useful, because sometimes I think particularly women, and then if you're an artist as well, it can be hard to talk. People don't really want to talk about money.
Yeah. Yeah, it can be really awkward.
Kind
of, oh, we have to talk about money now.
Yeah.
We have to talk about the money thing.
But I'm a shark and I'm like, give me more.
Yeah, but I mean, there is a whole kind of psychology, isn't there, behind that if you do something for free, people value you as if you're free. Do you know what I mean? As in,
No, absolutely. Yeah. No,
the same way that if somebody gives me, like if somebody gives you a free t-shirt, it's valued differently than the t-shirt you spent 20 quid on.
Absolutely.
Like, naturally.
100%. Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? That's just the way it is. But no, like, what is the biggest, what's the worst things people have to do for free?
I honestly don't think there has been anything. I don't think so. I really don't. And, you know, generally, I suppose it's been book festivals, or it's been things like that. And sometimes I will do it. You know, there's a friend of mine runs a great festival for young adult fiction here in Dublin. And it's always so much fun. And there's a free bar afterwards, which I'm not really drinking. So that mightn't be as great a, but, you know, everyone's in really good form.
But that's the vibe. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And, you know, like, lots of authors come in from the UK and just to have the crack. So it's always like such a laugh. So I will happily do that for free. But, you know, other things, I think as well, you know, I write a column and I know how much, and it's been an interesting sort of shift, because I know how much I get paid for my column, and I know, let's say, how long that takes to write.
So you have a benchmark on your time.
Yeah, I do. And I suppose as well, I'm like, you know, I write that in my writing room, you know, in my house in Clonakilty. I don't have to get dressed, or you know, get my hair, my makeup done, or, you know, anything like that, which I do get done for events, and that's an extra expense, and, you know, things like that, and which is, I mean, we could get into that. I mean, even that is such a, I was talking to a friend of mine, so I'm going off topic slightly, but I was talking to a friend of mine who is also an author, hugely successful, and we were chatting about sort of really terrible photos that had been taken of us at the start of our career, and she said she said there's no one that sort of tells you, you know what, you should probably get
your hair and makeup done
before you're getting a photo done. Like, I mean, I did it myself, you know,
date of some of those early photos. And the thing is that whenever you say that, particularly to men, there is this sort of element of, well, you're an author and the book is what matters, and, you know, you're being really shallow. But actually, as a female author, you know that it's particularly when you're younger, because when I started I was like 28, 29, and you know, they want the nice photo of you, to kind of put, you know, in the paper. And it's not a part of the job that I like or that I enjoy, even though I do, like, I love getting my hair and my makeup done, but it's actually the photo. Then I'm like, oh shit, I have to get this photo taken.
Yeah.
So as soon as he picks up the camera, I'm like, oh no. I think there's a it kind of cuts both ways, because sometimes it's like, well, maybe you're more likely to get media attention if you are, let's say, a young woman, but then there's more pressure on you to sort of look a certain way.
And there's more
way.
Criticism if you don't.
Yeah, exactly. And there way, is more criticism that way. Oh, absolutely. We've talked about that, you know, like, it's that thing of, you know, I suppose I've been, you know, lucky enough, but it's always that fear when you go on television that there's going to be a comment like, you ugly bitch, or you fat bitch, or you know.
That's why I stopped doing, I used to do the Fashion Police thing on Exposé, where we'd basically talk, and I used to try to be very specific about people's outfits or their hair and makeup, and not, you know, not about their bodies and not about their faces and not about their personalities. Just be like, you know what, I don't like what you're doing here, and I don't think this really works, and that kind of thing. But every single time I would do it, I would get at least 5 comments about how fat or ugly or just like, stay to her, like, who does she think? And basically, I did get a fee for it, but it was a really small fee. And I then got back to them and I went, from now on, I'm charging X amount.
Yeah.
And I think I did it.
No, you agree. You're like €200. And then you're like, okay, so that's, you know, per like, I don't know, 5 insults. You're like, how much should I get paid?
No, it was never €200. I think it was 50 in the beginning. Right. And then I was like, so that's like a tenner an insult. And I was like, it's not worth it.
Yeah.
So that's basically, and it was kind of a pity, because I was like, I hate the idea that I will, you know, that I feel like I was kind of maybe like bullied off that screen, and like, I did really enjoy doing it, but then I really hated that afterwards.
I know.
I was like, that's just miserable.
And see, the thing is that you have to sort of weigh it up, and it's like, well, okay, I don't want to be bullied off. I don't want other younger women to sort of look at what's happening to me and feel scared or feel intimidated or feel like that they would never go on television or, you know, speak at a panel or, you know, speak at an event because they're afraid of getting, you know, criticism of their physical appearance, which, as a woman, when you've been socially conditioned to believe that, like, your inherent value is completely tied up in how you look, it's not that easy just to sort of dismiss that kind of criticism as, like, meaningless, you know. So there's that part of me that's like, no, I don't want to do that. I don't want to let them win. And then there was the other part of me that was like, actually, but I feel like really anxious and you know, unwell and upset, and actually maybe it's better if I just prioritize my mental health
yourself.
It's a really tricky, and then you feel guilty. Then I feel guilty for not doing it,
you know. Though there's a bit in Roxane Gay's book Hunger where she's talking about being a fat activist and being body positive, and she says basically that she really kind of tries to be body positive and, you know, kind of is a fat activist, but she was like, I actually don't like being this fat.
Yeah.
And she was like, because whether it's right or wrong, this is the world I'm living in, and I have to move around in this world.
Yeah.
And I can't find clothes, and I feel like I'm discriminated against. She was like, so I would like to lose weight. Oh my God, it was such a difficult read, but it was so, I think it was really worth it. I really felt grateful to her in that moment, because I felt like it was kind of going, okay, she's right. Like, sometimes you're like the bigger fight would be to keep doing this and to stand up and to be seen. But then it's costing me too much.
The toll that it takes personally is. But, you know, I see that with people who are, you know, involved in the repeal movement. And I see it with, you know, other activists. And it takes its toll, you know, particularly people who are sharing their personal stories and are being vilified on social media. And, you know, I mean, I think Tara Flynn is a friend, and I adore her, and I think the work that she does is so important. I think she's going to be remembered, you know. I think that history will remember the work that she's done. But I suppose, as her friend, I just feel devastated when I see this sort of commentary that you know, that she receives, and I just want to sort of wrap her up in cotton wool and just take care of her. And I think it's,
and kind of take her away from it.
Yeah, and I think it's that, you know, the political is the personal, and it's just very difficult, I think, to, which is why, as I said, I'm just so, I just have so much respect for people, you know, who are working in the abortion rights campaign, and
because even having had like a little taste of it and feeling like I had to pull away from my own, you know, mental health and well-being, I'm so grateful to them for continuing to do that work because, you know, they're doing it for all of us.
Yeah.
And
it's so important. Yeah. It's so difficult.
Yeah. And I feel very, you know, just very grateful and very lucky that we have people who will keep fighting the fight.
Yeah. No, it's so important. We've come to the end of our time in the Fitzwilliam Hotel. But before we go, who's in your movie? Can you tell us yet who's in your movie?
I'm so sorry. Well, we have the director and we have like a few of the main roles cast. And until people sign the dotted line, I just
really
can't
want to know.
Say anything.
I'm going to have to reread it because actually Only Ever Yours, not necessarily that it's my favourite. Well, I've only read two of your books because nobody sent me a preview copy of the new
surprised.
One. I'm devastated.
Well,
I'll just have to buy it like everyone else, which I actually have no problem with because if I paid $12.50 to watch Step Up High Water on YouTube, I can pay for your book.
What is that?
Oh my God. You know the Step Up, the like hip hop dance films?
Oh yeah.
So they have like a TV series on YouTube.
Oh my God.
And the first four episodes are free and then you pay $2.50 per episode. And it's worth it because I was like, I'll pay for your work. You're incredible dancers.
No, the production values are great. No, absolutely.
But I absolutely love that trash. Like Step Up, Coyote Ugly. I loved Coyote Ugly though.
I wonder how well that would hold up.
I don't think you should watch it again because I loved it and then I came home and I was like, I really want to get a job in a bar and like dance on it like those sexy girls. And then as I got older, I was like, maybe that's problematic.
Yeah. But everything from the 90s is problematic.
Yeah. But what I was going to say was that I loved Only Ever Yours and I think like when I heard that your book had been optioned, I remember thinking, I actually hope it's Only Ever Yours because I love asking for it as well, but it's, I don't know, I would find that more difficult. Mm. Like I'd be excited to go and see Only Ever Yours in a cinema, whereas asking for it, I think I'd be kind of going in going, oh, I better bring the bottle of water, some tissues.
I know. I mean, I'm interested to see what the play, because I presume, you know, obviously the rape isn't on screen, so I you know, that's obviously going to be the same, I presume, in the play. But I'm wondering, will it be one of those ones that we're all going to come
out? Will it be tough?
Wear the waterproof mascara.
I'm sure it will because like a lot of the difficult scenes. So asking for it for anybody who hasn't read it, idiots, you should. But it's about a woman in a small town in Ireland, a girl who in school is subjected to like rape and sexual assault at a party. And then afterwards, it's kind of about the aftermath and what happens to her and what happens to her friends.
Yeah.
But some of the most moving scenes in that to me, like in the book, were with her family, were
yeah.
at home as they were
yeah.
all grappling with how to yeah. talk to her about it and how to deal with it.
I know.
Whereas Only Ever Yours, not that it's necessarily a fun story, but it is more fun because it's kind of dystopian.
No, and I know, and I can't wait to see that. Like, I can't wait to see sort of how they've created the world and what. Because, to be honest, I just thought of my own common school, and then which is the only thing that I sort of, I mean, I've obviously a complete lack of imagination because when I was creating this dystopian universe, I was like, sure, it'll be Sacred Heart and Kind of Guilty, it'll be grand. Well, you know, school for a teenage girl is a dystopia, so
yeah. Whereas I have a vision of it being very futuristic and very clean and
oh,
white
yeah.
and plasticized everything.
Yeah,
but
that's
I am
probably
really excited
more what
to
they're
see that.
Do I think.
But I wonder who, because I kind of, I'm thinking
I'm
about,
not going
like,
to tell you.
No, I know. But like thinking out loud that I actually am not very, I'm not very in touch with the teenagers in Hollywood these days. So
yeah.
I'll need to go and do
oh,
some and research.
I think, see, the
Abigail
thing
Breslin's
is,
too old now.
With the teenagers ancient. Going to be relatively, you know, not unknowns, but sort of, you know, not like super famous.
New.
But it's the
new
yeah. yes, but it's the older actors, you know, like for the Chastities and for the Father. So they want those.
God,
to
I haven't even thought about them.
Okay, we have to wrap this up, Rosemary.
Okay. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us on How to Be Sound.
No, thank you for having me.
And where can people find you if you want them to?
Oh God, well I'm so tempted at the moment just to throw my phone into the sea, go down to Alahees or somewhere on the Barra Peninsula and get a cottage there that has no Wi-Fi and no phone reception. But yeah, if you want to find me, I'm on Twitter, I'm on Instagram, but you know, don't find me. Just go out and buy my books.
Yeah.
That would be...
Just buy the
yeah,
books.
All My Love is in stores now and I'm really proud of it and I think it's going to cause a bit of conversation, so I think, which is always sort of the aim with my work.
Yeah. Okay, Brill. Thanks
buy
so
it.
Much. Thank you so much for listening to How to Be Sound with Louise O'Neill. I have been and am Rosemary McCabe. You can find out more about me on rosemarymccabe.com with an A in my Mac or at Rosemary McCabe, MACCABE on pretty much all forms of social media.
A big thanks has to go to my producer, Liam Geraghty. His own podcast, Meet Your Maker, is available now. It's on season 2 and it is truly excellent and worth listening to. And of course, we would be nowhere without my patrons. I'd like to say a big thanks to Siobhan O'Rourke, Kira Norton and Paul Jeremiah Hayes for supporting How to Be Sound with their cash dollar. See you next time.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.